Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. So in a matter of hours, Milford is expecting its first big protest after George Floyd's death. And that's set for 4 o'clock this afternoon. Joining me this morning is Officer Mike DeVito of the Milford Police Department. And Officer DeVito, good to have you this morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you this morning, Melissa?
I'm doing okay. Thank you so much for asking. So first and foremost, what is Milford PD doing to make sure that this afternoon's event is going to be peaceful, not going to block traffic, things of that nature?
We're prepared for, well, we think we are. We're prepared for just about anything. We've just been following similar type cities and towns our size and whatnot and how their protests have gone. So that being said, we have a tremendous amount of manpower there. We want to make sure that the people that are attending the protests have every possibility to, you know, express themselves. So we want to let that run its course. And so we're going to try to marry the protesters to the rest of the, you know, the city and the flow it has to go. And we're flexible and we'll be able to adapt to whatever, you know, comes our way. At least we think we will be.
Now, Officer DeVito, since we last spoke, obviously it's been over a week that the protests have been going on, and not just here, but across the country. What has Milford been facing since this has all gone down? Have you seen a shift in the community? Have you heard more voices? Has the department gotten any direct, you know, measures towards them? Like, has anybody come to the department or anything? What have you noticed in the last week or so?
It has been fairly consistent with what you seen about. We kind of think that there's the quiet, you know, your support is kind of quiet. Your opposition is much more vocal, which we completely understand. We talked about this last week, and it certainly hasn't changed in a week, and it won't change for quite a while. The public's view of police, and we totally understand that. We said this last week that police were going to be painted with a very, you know, broad brush, and because of what happened out there, which you've seen it, there is no support among police for the actions that took place in Minneapolis or actions that are similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen police all over walking with and kneeling with in support of the protesters because we don't like what happened there.
Yeah.
We don't like the way human life was treated there, and we don't support that, and we train in opposition to that, but it's just going to be really hard and slow to explain that to people. So if you follow this morning, later on today, House Democrats are supposedly supposed to be introducing an act called, I believe it's the Justice and Police Act, and there's three major components to it: training, accountability, and transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that we already do here in Milford in our city, any use of force interaction in our police department has at least two or three layers of review. Whether or not there's a complaint filed, whether or not there's a camera that's rolling, no matter what, every one of ours is already reviewed on a daily basis, and has supervisors have to sign off on it. We have training. We have components in our hiring process to try to possibly weed out candidates that we think may end up being a problem down the road. So these are things that we already are fully involved in already now, and we just would have to be able to continue this and maybe even assist other agencies in exploring these avenues.
Yeah, so you sort of answered my next question, which was, I was hearing over the weekend that the Minneapolis Police Department is, for lack of a better term, they're basically cleaning house. They are going to be kind of looking through every single person in that department. And if you got to get the boot, you're going to get the boot. And they'd want to rebuild the entire department. which I know even if they do that is going to take some time to bridge mm-hmm. the comfort level of the public. Now, these sound like discussions that are already going on in Milford to make sure it stays clean. Violence isn't tolerated like that. But you just said, that if you spot somebody within the training that maybe could be a liability, they don't get cleared for Milford. Do you mind just kind of sharing with us, what are maybe some red flags that you could see in the training process that would say, hey, you know what, you're not a fit for Milford Police. We're not letting you forward.
It even goes back, we'll take it a step back. We even mm-hmm. go prior to that. So we set up our own written and our own oral tests here, and we try to our best to what we're trying to do during those is really vet these these employees that are trying to get hired.
Sure.
And try to put them into positions where we could be able to, identify issues. So we're trying to see if they're really able to, work their way through things. In other words, we don't want them to right away. We try to see if they identify everything as a nail, because everything as a nail, if you identify it as a nail, you have to be a hammer.
Sure. So like almost like a trigger, see if anything triggers them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
We're trying to see if they're able to, have the ability to work their way through these things. And again, they have no training.
Right.
But it's still able to, maybe pull out, how they may have some deep-rooted issues.
Mm.
So we try to pull that out during the written exam and during the oral exam, and certainly during our training. Now, we're on, we run our own police academy. It's a regional police academy. We also are fully aware of the trend towards changing policing. Now, police training, and I get it, from the militaristic look to the more of like the college campus. So we believe that there's a spot there in the middle that would be best. We don't think that training should be, you arrive at 8:20 for 8 o'clock class like you can do in college, and you mm-hmm. walk in through a front door and with flip-flops on. We're not that far, but we do understand that, if you train a certain way, you'll end up, working that way. So we know that the training needs to change slightly to a softer, different mold. And we are in the process of doing that now, where we will be changing our academy going forward.
Mm.
Not quite settled on the exact model yet, but like anything, there's usually somewhere in the middle that we think would be the correct mode.
Continuing our conversation with Officer Mike DeVito of the Milford Police Department. Now, Officer DeVito, right before we took a break, you were talking about how there are sort of triggers that the Milford Police Department uses well before people go into training or into the academy to see if how they'll react to certain situations, essentially, to see if they're even, can be considered to become an officer at some point. And my question was going to be in regards to that. Is that something that every police department does? Is that like a protocol that most departments will follow, which is finding triggers before you even bother training these potential officers?
Well, this certainly is the goal. And one of the difficult tasks is trying, if there is a possibility that a candidate, could have, some issues, but have not been brought to the forefront just yet. So, i.e., they have not been arrested. They don't have any documented mental health issues, and more importantly, the other issues weren't rooted out during the psychological or the polygraph exam. So, in that case, sometimes they are able to maybe sneak through. But certainly, that is the goal of all, is to try to hire the best, the most suitable employees, so that over the next 20 to 25 years, there hopefully won't be any issues. And by no means do we claim to be, 100% successful, but certainly that is our goal. I mean, we don't want to welcome, future issues by any means. Knowing that they will arise and trying to limit them is certainly our one of our number one goals. And trying to, we don't want to send ill-suited employees out to interact with the public. That is not our goal whatsoever.
Sure.
At all.
Absolutely. Now, if you do spot something, and I don't mean, look, we're all human. There are going to be triggers in all of us. Some people have past experiences that make them, trigger. There's really a no judgment zone here. But, if you saw something that would be considered a real red flag, let's just say you had questions on an exam and consistently somebody showed that they may experience that they are racist. Is that something that even though Milford's like, hey, you know what, you're not fit for our department, we're not going forward with you, is that something that you would then let other departments know, hey, be aware of this guy or gal because she or he may bring some danger to your department? Or are you relying on other departments to also have these trigger tests in place?
Yeah, so the answer would be yes, and I'll explain how. So on applications, and there's a reason why, applicants are always asked to list the departments that they're applying to and which stage they're at. So I'm in this department, I've applied, I've submitted my paperwork, I've taken the written, so that we're able to cross-reference this stuff. And
okay.
Then once they are, if they are, say red flag at a certain department, that will be, it is transparent and it is shareable because they do sign a waiver when they go to each and every department. And the waiver allows us to go get each and any kind of paperwork documentation that's on them, including their applications to other departments and their testing and the results. So, yes, a failed polygraph or a failed psychological is documented, it is kept, and it is shareable, for lack of better terms. And that will set that employee back with all agencies for many years, unless it's something that they could, bounce back and recover from, but it won't happen quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking to Officer Mike DeVito of the Milford Police Department. And Officer DeVito, before I let you go, just out of curiosity, obviously you are somebody who's been in law enforcement for quite some time, and I know that you have a lot of connections to this industry, of course. Have you heard of officers either in other parts of the state or even the country who have not been, I will say, as lucky as the Milford Police Department? I know you and I had discussed a little bit over the weekend that in my own family, my husband's uncle is the sergeant of the Worcester, Massachusetts Police Department, and protesters there have thrown bricks, rocks, dumpsters, among many other things, at him and his department while they're trying to keep the peace. You know, anything that you've heard about, just personally, that you wanted to shed light on this morning?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to officers in New Haven and Bridgeport and in Stamford, and they've had slightly the protests weren't as peaceful as we would like. I don't think it's asking too much for people to attend a protest and fully support what they want, expect change, demand change, expect to be at some point to meet and speak with the proper authorities. I'm 100% for that, and change needs to come, and it needs to come through civil conversation, which can become testy at times. I understand that too, but I don't think in a civilized society, which is what we all want, it's ever advocated that we throw rocks or bricks or bottles at each other, or certainly at police or Molotov cocktails. I don't know that there's ever a time when that's okay. Even understanding that people are upset and they're not thrilled with police right now, and I get all that, but in a civilized society, which we are, we certainly would lean towards that. I don't think it's ever okay to throw items or to destruct and destroy items. So again, we promote and we welcome protests. Hopefully, they stay relatively calm, and I know they're going to be heated at words. We're informing our officers that it'll be as non-confrontational as humanly possible today and throughout this whole process this afternoon and into the early evening, however long it lasts.
Officer Mike DeVito, I always appreciate getting your insight. Thank you so much for taking the time with the Milford Police Department, and I will talk to you soon.
Yes, we'll talk to you next week. Have a great week. Thank you.
Chatting this morning with State Senator Tony Wong. State Senator, thanks for being here with us. How are you?
I'm wonderful, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So before I get to some of the questions I had planned for today, something that actually caught my attention while I was speaking with Officer Mike DeVito earlier. He said a bill apparently is going to be discussed with House Democrats tackling having to do with police. But apart from that, I was thinking, I'm going to ask you, are there bills currently here in Connecticut that have to be addressed? Anything surrounding police, maybe diversity in our departments, anything like that?
Absolutely. And Connecticut should be proud of the movement that we have, apart from many other states. I was very proud to be part of co-sponsoring and standing with our state Senate in Connecticut Public Act 19-90, which required the release of body and dashboard camera videos within 96 hours of any incident upon request. this is really a timely check and balance with law enforcement agencies. And the second part of it is it sets a new standard for requiring a quick turnaround of information to the public. It also prohibits police from shooting or shooting into a fleeing vehicle. And it also expands the incidence of reports on the use of chokeholds, pursuit, or anything that would likely cause serious injury.
Mm.
These are really steps forward in addressing the incidences of brutality and inappropriate police action. And we passed that in a unanimous basis. And that is in effect. But I think we need to do more. And I think some of the legislation you're talking about, Melissa, would be in the area of increasing the capacity for body cameras.
Mm, yeah. Now, when did that pass, Senator?
It actually passed in 2015, Melissa.
Okay, yeah.
And we allocated state funding and resources for towns to use that money because, obviously, small towns may not have the capacity for the cost of storage and updates. But we provided money, and there's still money in the pool for that service. So there's nearly 60 towns that have not taken advantage of this. I think it's an absolute requirement to have the body camera to expose and to create transparency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we talk about George Floyd and that despicable act of hatred and violence, if that was not caught by a phone camera of a bystander, we would have still been uncertain in the debate and the quagmire of information and who did, who didn't.
You're right.
So the body camera is a critical part of transparency, and we've been an advocate in the beginning of that. So body camera is one thing. I think other parts in the legislation, I'd be happy to go into a little bit more, Melissa, if you like, that I think we should undertake as well.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would love to get your take on what else we could do to, like you said, expand the bill you just talked about. And also, I know the governor has talked about, you know, we need to work on the diversity just in our own state police, let alone our department. So I don't know if you could touch on that as well.
Well, the governor has been supportive, but I think his words were some of these actions are very vague in the broad term. We know it's an issue that needs to be addressed. What are the specifics? And I can answer two specifics in my mind from my experience.
Yeah.
I think the first thing is to address the freedom of information, access to transparency. One part is the body camera, but unfortunately, just last year, we voted on a state trooper contract which allowed for the suppression of access to information on police conduct, police behavior, police complaints. So I think that is one grave mistake that we had in our legislative session last year. And I would encourage that we go back in and address the exemption from freedom of information for our state trooper actions. You know, Mr. Chauvin in Minneapolis had nearly 17 cases reports of, you know, excessive use of violence, and it was never reported.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think the freedom of information, transparency again, and accountability is critical. I think we can get right back to work and address that. I think the other part, Melissa, is having a community advocate, a voice from the people to be able to speak up and be heard and create an awareness and education and interaction. I want to compliment, you know, community policing. You know, when we talk about the state troopers, I've worked with Sergeant Derry, who's been on the show, and you know, Dare Officer Cummings. These are people that are very engaged in the community.
Mm-hmm.
They bring a face of accountability and interaction. We need more of that from our police authorities to interact with the community. We need to take a look at a person, you know, centered judgment in policing of determining between good and bad, all right?
Absolutely.
You know, not a person being good or bad, but determining what's right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So those are important things that we can do legislative, and I'm really glad, and thank you very much for raising these points.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we're talking to State Senator Tony Wong. And what's interesting about what you just said, Senator, is in Minneapolis, I don't know if you heard about this, but they want to do essentially, they want to clean house with the Minneapolis Police Department and sort of eliminate as many police officers that could be a threat to the public as possible, which amen to that, because there's clearly a huge systematic issue going on there. And the way they want to do it is they would like it to be community-based being involved in that process of what exactly they're looking for. What would secure that community that police are not going to abuse people of color going forward or abuse people that are a different diversity background? And I think, you know, to your point, I think it would also be maybe a good idea here in Connecticut, even though we haven't seen maybe to the same extent of George Floyd, we absolutely have seen racism time and again happen here, unfortunately. And maybe it is time that we have some public input on how we go forward. How do we make our police departments better?
Well, you bring up a very important question, and community policing is essential for us to reflect the community that we serve. Understanding the culture, the dynamics, and the emotion and the challenges that each community has. Community policing has to be essential, but it's much more than just the police actions. It is a systemic issue, Melissa, and that's what the challenge is. We have to look at housing. We have to look at being able to recruit and retain members of the community to get involved with law enforcement. It's a challenge right now because it's not just one thing. Mm-hmm. It has to be a systemic assessment of how we look at policing as an integral part of the community and how do we allow everybody to want to be a part of the solution, not being part of the antagonistic battles that we have. So when you talk about community policing, it is important for people to get to know each other and understand, but it's far more greater in complexity because of systemic issues. Mm-hmm. Some of the officers can't afford to live in some of the communities. There are challenges in regards to prejudgment and pre-biases going in that doesn't allow them to be part of that solution moving forward. So we have a lot of work to do from a standpoint of awareness, education, but most important of all, a sense of community engagement.
Phase two set for next Wednesday now, Senator. It was supposed to be next Saturday, but they bumped it up 3 days because of Father's Day weekend. Do you think the governor is on track or moving too quickly? We have a split, I would say, look on this from our listeners. Some people are very excited for phase two. Others feel like, hey, you know, we're moving way too quickly, and why move things up any faster because of a holiday weekend? What are your thoughts on this?
That has always been the delicate balancing mm-hmm. act, right, Melissa, in regards to the health considerations versus the need for us to get businesses and activities back to some semblance of normal.
Right.
That will always continue to be a balancing act. But for me, we have to base it upon medical facts. And the data points that the governor puts out every year, every day practically, is important relative to declining trends, but also, you know, understanding that the established protocols are followed. That's important. But what's a real concern is there's a difference in the state of Connecticut as a whole. When you look at Fairfield County, which is, as you mentioned earlier, right next door to the epicenter of the world in regards to the COVID crisis, mm-hmm. New York City, the contagious nature of the disease and the proximity raises a significant caution alarm to people in Fairfield County. And that's maybe why the hesitancy, because when you look at someone in Windham County in eastern Connecticut, they've had only 397 cases.
Right.
And less than three deaths. You know,
it's like night and day.
Remarkable numbers,
mm-hmm.
right? Because ultimately, it really is a reminder of 14 deaths in Windham. I apologize. Any death is too many. But in Fairfield County, consumers and businesses are treading very carefully because of the epicenter nature. So for me, I think, one, it has to be medically based that we're on a declining trend. Two, all of our businesses and the consumers has to follow the established protocols. Wear a mask when you're outside, not only for your own safety, but for the safety of people working and the surrounding environment.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is we have to be cautious in regards to whether the businesses is sustainable. You know, you push to open, there's no customers coming in. It creates an additional pressure because the guidelines that's being established, and anybody who wants to open during that time can go to the portal on DECD, Connecticut DECD, that has very strict self-certifications. They're tremendous cost to opening, and there are balancing acts that we have to address.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, Melissa, we have to do better based on mental facts, better testing, and better protocols, but ultimately it's an individual choice. It may be open. That doesn't mean you have to go.
Right. Exactly. This and it doesn't mean that they are necessarily going to open. That's the other thing. I could remember when phase one started, a lot of people calling and saying, I thought you said this would open. Well, it's actually up to the establishment if they want to open. That's the earliest they can. Now, I know we are coming up on the end of our time here, but I needed to address this with you. I don't mean to put you in the hot seat, but vaccines. We've got to talk about this because we're coming up on flu season in a matter of months. We are going to probably see another wave of COVID-19. When does this become another conversation for lawmakers here in Connecticut and pushing families to possibly vaccinate their children and maybe eliminate the religious exemptions? Because now you've got two deadly viruses and now you're putting kids at even more of a threat. So when do lawmakers go back to the drawing board to talk about what to do with vaccinations?
Well, vaccination is an important part to the solution of us moving forward, without a doubt. But we're hearing mixed stories, and I'm very proud to be part of the Bioscience Initiative in Connecticut to try to find these solutions. So to answer that, vaccinations is absolutely critical to be part of the solution for us to move forward. But at the same time, right now there is no vaccination, and we're looking at enforcement and actions without any real understanding of what the vaccination's effects, after effects, and what the real potency of it is. So I would share with you this. We need to strive to find a solution to help people can make that choice to protect themselves. But at the same time, we don't have one right now. So the most important and cautious thing that people can do is practice the measures that we have always talked about, even for many years before COVID, about flu prevention and flu cautions. Constantly wash your hands to be able to protect yourself from a hygiene aspect of contamination. If you're sick and not feeling well, stay home. Mm-hmm. Protect yourself, protect others. Those are protocols that have been established for every flu season that people don't adhere to. And I hope
right.
that we'll adhere to kind of the individual conduct. But to talk about a vaccine, it's critical, but there isn't one yet. So
right.
what can we do? The protocols that we talked about earlier, the individual conduct to protect yourselves and those in courtesy of others around you is the best preventive measure that mm-hmm. we have. And I encourage everybody to do that. But, Melissa, you know, it's very hard to make everybody comply.
No question.
You're going to have naysayers who says, mm-hmm. nah, it won't happen to me.
Right.
That's the struggle. How do we, as legislators, we can't. Mm-hmm. We can't control individual behavior. We can provide guidelines and support, but ultimately it's an individual's action which governs what they do, and sometimes they don't make the right ones.
Right. A big challenge certainly ahead of us and certainly for the lawmakers here in Connecticut. Well, Senator Tony Wong, I appreciate you giving us extended amount of time this morning talking about really great subjects, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Melissa. Thank you. Be safe and healthy, everyone.
So let's face it, the pandemic has proven to challenge everyone. Parents, you're juggling work from home. Kids, you're virtually learning. Some seniors haven't even left their homes in months. So it's safe to say we are out of a routine, which can lead to a lot of difficulties. But do you ever take a second and think about how this health emergency has really impacted children or even adults with autism? To give us a little bit of perspective on this is Carrie Sasu, who is the Director of Strategic Initiatives, Center of Excellence on Autism Spectrum Disorders at Southern Connecticut State University. Carrie, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Melissa. I'm very good this morning.
Great. So even when you don't put a pandemic in the mix, can you start by talking about how challenging maybe an average day is for someone with autism if they don't have a set plan in place or their schedule is out of place?
Absolutely. Yeah. So many people with autism benefit from predictable schedules that allow them to navigate their days and know what's forthcoming. And, you know, that's one of the common characteristics of individuals on the spectrum is that they often have restricted or repetitive patterns of behavior or interests and activities. So certainly adherence to routines is important to many individuals with autism spectrum disorder, and deviations from those routines, even if minor, certainly can increase feelings of anxiety pretty significantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and of course, what's interesting about the autism spectrum, just from having a brother on the spectrum, you could vary. You could have people who are very high functioning. You could have people who are very severe to light, touch, sounds, interactions, things like that. So there are many variations of autism in different people. So with what you just talked about, that is a main basis for autistic children or adults. So now let's throw a pandemic in, where everyone's normal routines are completely out of whack. So how challenging does it now become for people with autism with the times we're living in right now?
Absolutely. And I really appreciate what you just said in terms of highlighting the diversity of individuals on the spectrum, because it is a very diverse population. So that's important for us to acknowledge. And I really appreciate that you did say that. But
no,
you're
no
right.
Problem.
Throwing a pandemic into this whole mix, you know,
good
the loss of predictability and typical routines has likely resulted in increased anxiety for all of us,
mm-hmm.
whether we're neurotypical or we have an autism spectrum disorder. But certainly for people with an autism spectrum disorder, loss of that typical routine, you know, may have made days away from their teachers or their service providers or their coworkers really difficult, because it is that change in routine that's unsettling. But for others, you know, to your point, for others, moving into a new routine wherein they don't have kind of the added challenges associated with navigating the social landscape every day may have kind of significantly reduced some of the anxiety that they feel kind of going out and navigating the world. So for some, it could be preferable to be home and navigating things through virtual means.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, every person with autism is unique. So the ways that each person on the spectrum has been impacted is probably just as different as it is for the rest of us.
Yeah, that's so true. Because for introverts, like you said, this has actually been delightful, and not in a mean way, but it's been delightful to not have to socialize, to not be forced to go out of your homes or to do more than the simple, I guess I would say, like the simple day-to-day things. You're not really forced to go out into society, whereas extroverts have very much struggled with the pandemic. So, you know, just like that, you're saying it's kind of the same with people who have autism. You know, some people may have adjusted to a new schedule and they're doing perfectly fine, whereas others are really struggling with this. That's a very interesting point. And I'm thinking from a society standpoint, if you're somebody who either works with someone who's autistic, or you're someone who comes across someone who maybe does have, let's just say, a tantrum in public while they're walking, what mm-hmm. would you say to people before they judge a child or an adult with special needs?
Yeah, so I that's such a wonderful question. I appreciate you asking it. And I just would like to encourage everyone to remember that all of us, you know, try to do the best with what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we all have strengths and we all have weaknesses, you know, and this is no different, certainly for individuals with special needs. So as a parent, I have three children. One of my children does have an autism spectrum disorder. And I'd like to ask people to remain mindful that, you know, if they see children with special needs engaging in behaviors that are unusual or puzzling to them, please know that they may be trying to communicate how they're feeling or what they're experiencing or what their need is in the best and only way they possibly can. You know, they're using the tools or the skills that they have. So the other thing is, too, you know, as parents, most of us would rather you ask about our children rather than sort of stand silently and perhaps make a judgment about that. We want our children to be seen and appreciated. And, you know, the best way to do that is, you know, to increase all of our collective understanding and start having conversations about differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Carrie, for us, growing up with my brother, Matthew, what was so challenging is that he was never somebody who he didn't look different, if that makes sense. I mean that in the most, in the nicest way I can. Matthew looked as typical, and I'm putting air quotes on typical,
right.
as any other person would look. And I think when he had these instances of that was a weird thing he said, or that was kind of an awkward facial expression he made, that's when he was judged. And I think that that's the part that maybe people struggle with. Autism doesn't really look like, let's just say, you know, Matthew had friends who had Down syndrome, where you could visibly sometimes see that, okay, maybe there's something that's a little bit different, and that's okay. I find that kids with autism especially really sometimes, I think, get judged or get bullied because you don't see it right away until something kind of odd comes up or you notice they have an outburst and you think, well, what's wrong with that person? I mean, I don't know if that's something that you've experienced, but I know for us, that's been a challenge in all of Matthew's growing up until he's even become an adult to this day.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that a lot of parents, you know, who have shared their, or family members, as you've recounted your experience, who have shared their experiences have said very similar things. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish that people could recognize the difference immediately so they could be a little bit more understanding. Because you're right, there is nothing that presents necessarily that identifies an individual as having autism. So it is a really difficult thing when someone passes judgment either on you as an individual with autism or as a parent of an individual with autism, as, you know, attributing their struggles or their behavior, which appears odd, to either poor parenting or, you know, malicious behavior or something of that nature. That's a really difficult thing to contend with.
Absolutely. Carrie Sasu, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but you have given us such insight this morning that I think, like you said, we're all kind of going through this weird time period together. So that's a good thing. But, you know, there's always somebody who is maybe struggling a little bit more or who is reacting a little bit differently than we would think. So I appreciate you shedding some light on this situation this morning, and hopefully it serves as some insight for many people. So thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I really appreciate you also being an advocate for folks on the spectrum.
Absolutely. Always and forever. Very proud, and thank you so much. I look forward to having you on the show again. Thank you, Carrie.
Thanks very much, Melissa.